So good afternoon. I want to start today by once again.
I'm Radio Boston's Tiziana Deering. We're interrupting here and now to bring you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily press briefing on the coronavirus. Here's the governor.
It is a profoundly challenging time for all of us, unlike anything I've ever been a part of. But the many acts of kindness, compassion, bravery, and creativity that we hear every day remind us that you are all very special. We have several announcements and updates we'd like to share with you today. We continue to make progress in expanding our testing apparatus, which is a critical part of identifying and stopping the spread of the virus. Yesterday, we reported nearly 20,000 people have been tested, and we expect to continue to increase the number of tests completed every single day. This time last week, we had completed about 2,600 tests. Last week, Secretary Sutters announced a partnership between the Commonwealth and the Broad Institute, which is a Harvard-MIT joint venture to help increase testing capacity. The testing at the Broad started yesterday, and we expect to be reporting those numbers along with the other labs that are testing by Friday. The Broad Institute has unique experience in the testing field, and from discussions with them, we expect that they will be able to process as many as 2,000 additional tests a day once they ramp up. All in, we now have 21 labs testing samples here in the Commonwealth. As I've said before, I want to remind people that as we continue to increase the number of tests, we expect to see case numbers rise as well. But more tests means more people know for sure whether they have COVID-19, and from there, those who test positive can work with their healthcare providers and others to take the steps that they and we need to take to limit the spread, and the people they interact with can do the same. This tracing and isolation work is one of the main ways we save lives and reduce the spread. I also want to remind people that if you have questions on whether or not you should be tested, you should begin by contacting your healthcare provider, who will walk you through the steps. We've also increased access to telehealth over the last few weeks, giving more people the ability to connect with their providers remotely. A phone call or a video chat with a trusted clinician is now a covered benefit. Think of it as another form of purposeful social distancing, one that works for patients and for clinicians. Today, our administration is pleased to announce a new effort to ensure the care and safety of the Boston area's homeless population during the COVID-19 outbreak. A former Boston Medical Center hospital called the Newton Pavilion, which is now a state asset, will be temporarily reopened to support the medical needs of area homeless residents. Newton Pavilion, owned by the state, but this new facility will be operated by a consortium of providers, including Boston Medical Center, Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, shelters in the city, including the Pine Street Inn, and the City of Boston's COVID-19 response team. The facility will be used as needed for a range of care needs and potentially treatment for homeless patients. This includes homeless patients who test positive for COVID-19 or awaiting test results. The facility will provide a safe, isolated place for people to stay and recover if they don't require hospitalization. Acute care for sicker patients, including ICU care, can also be made available. Newton Pavilion will also serve as a post-discharge facility for patients who don't have a home to return to. The whole facility has the capacity for about 250 beds. We certainly view this as a critical step to helping the Commonwealth secure enough space and care for homeless individuals that become infected, and we are grateful to our partners that have made this possible. And over the course of the past several weeks, we've been working with the City of Boston on this issue. They continue to stand up, identify, and staff additional locations to service and support Boston's homeless community. Two locations opened last week, the Barbara McGinnis House and 112 Southampton Street. The city also announced $2.5 million in grants to strengthen healthcare systems for the homeless population and the city's most vulnerable residents. By next week, Boston expects to open an additional facility for further care options if it's needed. Today, our administration also submitted a request through FEMA to the President for federal disaster assistance in response to the COVID-19 epidemic. This request for a major disaster declaration, if approved, would provide the Commonwealth additional federal assistance beyond what was included in the emergency declaration I announced on March 13th. The major disaster declaration would give support and flexibility to our communities as they respond to the COVID-19 outbreak. This would include a request for FEMA's public assistance program, which would make financial assistance available to cities and towns, state agencies, and certain nonprofits statewide. The disaster declaration also requests FEMA's individual assistance program, including disaster unemployment assistance and crisis counseling assistance, to help support our residents. The disaster unemployment assistance program provides benefits for workers that do not qualify for support through the regular UI program and would mitigate the impact of this disaster on this particular group of workers. We hope to see the feds move on this quickly so that we can get those resources deployed to our residents as soon as possible. From every corner of government, our administration will continue to take swift action to support the health, safety, and financial security of our residents during this unprecedented time. Many of you watching today have been working remotely and spending most of your time in your homes at our request to help us mitigate the spread of COVID-19. I can't tell you how much the Lieutenant Governor and I, and everybody who's part of our administration, appreciates how frustrating and difficult this is for you and your loved ones, but we are so grateful for your continued cooperation and patience. These are uncertain times, for sure, unprecedented, but we're confident that we can get through this together. To all the parents juggling work and kids at home, thank you, thank you, thank you. We know how hard a few days at home with young children can be. From what we hear, so many parents are coming up with great ways to keep kids learning and engaged, which comes, of course, as no surprise. I want to thank you for your patience and your creativity. The people of Massachusetts have always been known for their resiliency and grit during the most challenging times, and this time is no exception. We ask you to please continue to stay informed and use common sense to keep your families and loved ones healthy. You have our commitment that we will keep doing everything we can to ease the burdens of this virus and all of the burden that has been placed on so many across our Commonwealth. And we continue to encourage everyone to subscribe to our new text alert system by texting COVIDMA to 888-777, and we promise we will not overload you with alerts and updates. Continue to get your news from trusted sources and official channels like mass.gov/COVID-19. I'd now like to turn the podium over to Secretary Sutters, who's going to talk about an exciting new opportunity to engage healthcare volunteers within our communities. Secretary?
Actually, Governor, that exciting opportunity is going to be announced tomorrow, but he's given you the header for tomorrow.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Good afternoon, everybody. Just to pick up on a couple of things that the governor mentioned on the COVID mass to 888-777. As of last night, there was more than 110,000 individuals had signed up for alerts. And as the governor mentioned about working with our with homeless shelter providers, particularly on the individual side, we're here to support the City of Boston in their efforts. They take the lead, and we're here to support them in that. And the Newton Pavilion was a very significant step for us to step up and provide sort of a, if you know Barbara McGinnis House, it's like a Barbara McGinnis kind of a model, which is sort of a step down from hospital level of care to be operated by, as the governor said, a consortium of homeless providers in Boston Medical Center. In fact, as I stand with you today, on the phone is my staff in concert with the Department of Public Health and MEMA staff with other homeless providers in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, of which there's 42, literally working with them what their needs are so that we can help them stand up what services they need to both provide social distancing, disinfect, and set up potential quarantine sites for them as they need them across the state, because what works in Boston is different than what works in Pittsfield is what will work differently in Springfield. To give you just a couple of other updates, we continue to work the supply chain hard to ensure that we can increase supplies of PPE, personal protective equipment. As of yesterday, we had prepared and shipped out 68 deliveries of PPE to sheriff departments, local fire and police, and healthcare entities across the Commonwealth. To date, between MEMA and DPH, we have sent more than 150 shipments of supplies over the last 2 weeks. Yesterday, we sent more than 10,000 swabs to 55 sampling sites, those are hospitals, community health clinics, et cetera, to enable them to continue collecting patient samples to send for labs. And since Sunday, we've distributed more than 28,000 masks and 120,000 pairs of gloves. But we know we continue to need to move the supply chain in order for us to have sufficient supplies in the Commonwealth. And since the command center was stood up, we've placed more than $50 million in orders for PPE and working with suppliers to expedite shipping to the Commonwealth. As you know, as we've announced before, we've requested additional supplies from the Strategic National Stockpile. To date, approximately 17% of our requests have been filled. We received a third confirmation of our delivery, but it's not yet been received. In addition to protecting individuals who are homeless, there's another group of individuals, people with profound disabilities, that are important for us to protect. In Massachusetts, there are just over 36,000 individuals who are MassHealth recipients who have significant disabilities and receive what is referred to as personal care attendant services at home. Without these personal care attendant services, these individuals would be at risk of being placed in nursing homes. PCA services are essential services that support individuals with disabilities with what we refer to as activities of daily living, such as dressing, grooming, bathing, ambulating. In order for these individuals to stay home and not be at risk of placement into a nursing home, they have to have PCA services. PCAs in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts are represented by SEIU Local 1199. So we've been working with the disability community, 1199, to come up with some alternatives in the event that a PCA was unable to come to work. So in a unique collaboration in these times, we partnered with Home Health, the 150 home health agencies, 1199, and the disability community to deploy home health aides to consumers if their PCA is unable to come to work. We stood up a dedicated hotline, which actually is a number, may not be familiar to you all, but it's actually a number that's familiar to people in the disability community. And it ensures that there is a warm handoff. The number is 1-844-422-6277, and it went live yesterday. Gratefully, at this point, calls to the hotline are small, but we are, obviously, we're assuming if we continue to have community spread, that PCAs will be affected. And again, it's extraordinarily important for these 36 individuals to be able to maintain their independence and safety at home. As we continue to prepare our healthcare system to ensure that we have both the physical space and staff to care for a surge in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, yesterday we announced three additional orders that ensure patient safety, but continue to give hospitals and healthcare systems the flexibility that they will need to attend to a surge. One is on nurse staffing. We are temporarily exempting all hospitals licensed in the Commonwealth from the acuity assessed staffing and nurse to patient ratio requirements that were established in law. We have paused the determination of need process in order for facilities who need to seek approval for substantial capital expenses or transfer of site to do renovations in response to the COVID-19 outbreak, that they can do that without regulatory hurdles. This will allow healthcare facilities that needed flexibility to increase bed and care capacity during this public health emergency. And finally, we've issued an order and guidance to licensed pharmacies and pharmacists to help maintain access to prescription medication throughout the COVID-19 outbreak. The measures include, and I'm not going to go through them all, it authorizes pharmacy technicians to remotely process patient prescriptions. It allows pharmacists to dispense medication refills to ensure therapy continuation for chronic conditions. It allows pharmacists who are licensed in other states and in good standing to practice within Massachusetts to operate in Massachusetts in a licensed pharmacy or healthcare facility. It also conserves sterile compound garb when there's a documented shortage of potential shortages. As we continue to identify issues that we need to address to reduce regulatory barriers, but that ensure safety in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we will continue to address them so that we're prepared in the event of a surge. Thank you, Governor.
Questions for any of us?
Well,
first of all, the unemployment numbers are obviously a reflection of what I think everybody's seeing going on in the economy, not just here in Massachusetts, but around the country. As states have gotten very aggressive about implementing social distancing criteria and eliminating all non-essential employment and changing the very nature of the way other operations work, that has put a tremendous number of people out of work. And as I said earlier this week, by moving to the cloud, which we did 2 years ago, we have the ability to absorb literally the 15-fold increase in applicants that came through the system over the course of the past 7 or 8 days. I think in many ways, this is going to be one of the biggest challenges that states are going to face over the course of the next several weeks, which is processing an unprecedented number of new unemployment claims and trying to get them into the system and loaded and paying as quickly as possible. But this is true everywhere. It's not just true in Massachusetts. I know there are hundreds of thousands of people who have filed an application, so which is, again, 15-fold what you would typically see in the course of a week. The one public service announcement I would make here with respect to this, which is really important for anybody who's filing, the employer, the actual name of the employer that has to go on that application is the name of your employer on your W-2 form. And that's the kicker that then ties your application to their records with respect to how much money you got paid so that they can determine what your actual allocation on unemployment insurance would be. And the reason I say this is because if you worked at Dunkin' Donuts, but you worked at a very particular Dunkin' Donuts that was owned by a particular franchisee or owned by corporate, you need to actually name that Dunkin' Donuts, because if you don't, if you just say Dunkin' Donuts, the claim's not going to process because that's not what's on your W-2. So point number one, when you file, make sure the filing has your actual name of the W-2, of the company on your W-2. That is, in many ways, one of the biggest single things that kicks a claim and then requires people to go through the process of making phone calls and dealing with that. The call center 15 days ago, had roughly 50 people in it. Now the call center has 300 people in it, and they're all working remotely, and by this time next week, it'll probably have over 400 people in it. They are making calls, they are taking calls, and also when people leave messages, calling people back to find out what the issue was with respect to the filing of their claim. I mean, our goal here is to get through this as quickly as we can, and having talked to a number of other states already, this is going to be a big challenge for everybody, but something that people believe absolutely positively has to get done as quickly as possible.
Have you any thought to
pushing back the tax filing deadline? Yeah, we've been talking to our colleagues in the legislature about this for several days. It requires a legislative fix to be done, and I think one way or another we'll figure something out here, but we don't have anything to say about it today. Well, the aid package that passed the Senate is now in the House, and at some point we assume that something like that's going to come out of the House and make it to the President's desk. There's a particular element in that bill which is designed to support people who haven't paid into the unemployment system, you know, the self-employed folks, consultants, people who work on 1099s. And the biggest challenge that states are going to face, and we're already thinking about how to deal with this, is if somebody's not already in the unemployment system, right, they don't have an employer who's paying in every month and giving everybody their wage data so everybody knows once they actually get their application filed what their actual benefit would be based on how much they make. We are working to figure out how we will actually accept those folks, determine what their wages were in some legitimate way, and then make sure that we can pay it out. I can promise you that we are glad that the feds put this into the mix and made this part of the equation, because for many of us, it was one of the biggest things we were wondering about how we were going to solve for. But we're going to have to create sort of an alternative universe over here to process people who aren't currently in the unemployment system because they don't work for somebody who pays unemployment taxes and they don't pay them themselves. So job number one, figure out who they are, how much they made, and then come up with a way to actually distribute funds to them based on the guidelines that are provided by the feds. But yeah, this is a really important thing. We're going to figure it out. So I wish you'd been here yesterday to ask Commissioner Riley that question. He would have been much better suited to answer it. And I would urge you to follow up with his office. I would say two things. The first is decisions about sort of progress and grading in Massachusetts have always been made at the school district level, and that will continue to be the case. That's not going to change. The second thing with respect to folks who are seniors, the big issue there will be how much can they actually get done between now and the end of the year. And one of the reasons we extended the period of time away was so that people could accept the fact that we had 5 weeks here of solid time that communities and the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education could work on to chase curriculum for kids that would be age appropriate. It also took a little while for the department to set up its partnership with WGBH-TV to make learning available to kids who don't have access to the internet, don't have a laptop, but virtually everybody's got a TV with public television on it. Say again? Yep. Yep. That sounds like a perfect question for the command center.
We've been working with the deans of the medical schools in Massachusetts for early graduation so that it's a cadre of individuals who could be licensed. I'm expecting that the deans are going to be making an announcement that apparently we're now doing a pre-announcement. So I don't think the deans have formally announced what the graduation dates would be, but we will be prepared if the schools graduate early to provide 90-day provisional licenses through the Board of Registration of Medicine, a one-page application. So in the event that the medical schools provide that, but that has to come from the deans, we're prepared to provide almost automatic 90-day licenses so that we would have a cadre of physicians in Massachusetts.
Secretary, while you're
out there, could you just answer our... Sure. I do my steps, you know, that's how... Yeah, they are.
As long as you distance appropriately from the government.
I'm actually worried about these two right here.
Could you tell us how concerned you are about doctors and nurses getting sick, getting COVID-19? And this seems to be a problem that's spreading.
So we are, my honest answer to you is I'm worried about anyone becoming symptomatic with COVID-19, testing positive. One of the things that we've been doing with the medical community, one of the things we've been doing, as you have heard, as we roll out these series of changes is, right, one, if physicians who had retired trying to expand the cadre is what I would say to you, So two things. One is trying to expand the cadre of nurses, physicians, techs, and the like by announcing a series of changes, such as physicians who've retired in good standing can automatically renew their licenses. Physicians, nurses, pharmacists, as three examples, who work in another state and they're licensed in good standing, right, can work in Massachusetts without going through the regulatory process of being licensed through the Board of Registration of Pharmacy, Nursing, or Medicine. So the announcement I just made about eliminating for now the fairly stringent nurse staffing ratios that makes sense when you're not in a pandemic, sort of removing them as long as there's a complete focus to safety. Those are some of the things that we're trying to remove. The working with the deans of the medical school, apparently, which is getting a pre-announcement today, of students who've been matched, if they graduate, getting them a 90-day license, so we have a cadre. We've asked for physicians and nurses at the federal level to be able to work in Massachusetts, and healthcare workers, in addition to people who are hospitalized, as you know, are at the top of our list for people who to get tested, so that if they test positive, then they're out for until they're asymptomatic, until they're cured, and then they can come back to work. So we are obviously, so the healthcare workforce is key to us, and I'm sorry, I just sort of rattled off a number of items. So again, we're trying to increase the cadre, as well as ensure that healthcare workers are in the priority group who are tested if they become positive for COVID-19 and they're out, and then try to get them back safely as possible. I'm sorry? Because as what we know from about COVID-19 is it's highly contagious, right? Unlike the flu, COVID-19 is a highly contagious disease. And so that is why the PPE is so important, and which is why we are literally every possible supply chain we can find, we are trying to maximize it. I'm staying here. Right. So the state lab is 24, 48 hours. I haven't checked today, so these are probably yesterday or the day before numbers. The commercial labs, as you know, was between 3 and 7 days. And I think when you saw the report, which was, I think, yesterday or the day before, and you saw that bolus from Quest Labs, right? So now that they can test in Massachusetts, that is much, much faster. So that was a catch-up. So I'm expecting, and with the Broad coming online, we start reporting tomorrow, I'm expecting that we're going to see much faster turnarounds, 24 to 48 hours. But we do know that particularly through some of the commercial labs, that the lag time was up to about 7 days. I heard Dr. Fauci also, so I am not an epidemiologist or researcher, and there's obviously a lot of research going on internationally by the WHO and nationally of looking at what this is a new strain of a coronavirus, which H1N1 is also in the family of coronavirus, but this is clearly a new strain, and we will, I'm hoping to get through this next few months. Oh, yes. Yes, ma'am.
This is WBUR, and you're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker and HHS Secretary Mary Lou Sutter's in the Daily State briefing on the coronavirus.
Right. Yeah, so PCAs are considered by us as healthcare workers, but again, we are, as the governor and I have said, we need not just an adequate supply in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we need a significant supply in Massachusetts so that anyone in healthcare, fire, police, and first responders have access to masks and gloves so that they can provide direct services. Thank you.
Last question.
Just let me follow up on a couple things the Secretary said. One is that there are a number of very significant manufacturers who've made a decision to repurpose their manufacturing processes to make a lot of this gear. Now, that doesn't happen overnight, but if you believe, I think as we do, that this is a challenge that's going to be with us for a while, at whatever level, having manufacturers who are focused on creating PPE, personal protective equipment, and having it just coming out as a matter of course and getting purchased is a huge part of how we get to the point where we are adequately prepared to provide that to everybody who's part of the community, whether it's first responders, healthcare workers, or others who are going to need access to it. The second thing I would say is that there's a tremendous amount of time and effort that's put into supply chain investigations with respect to this stuff generally, and I can't tell you how frustrated governors, including this one, are about the issue associated with landing the order. It's happened to us. It's happened to many governors across the country. This issue about landing the order is a very significant challenge for every single state. And on every call with the Vice President, the President, the coronavirus team in Washington, our big message to them is you gotta let us land the order. And it continues to be, in some respects, one of the biggest challenges we face. And FEMA has talked about creating a more coordinated approach to this. They talked about it today on the phone call that we had earlier with the administration. I think this is going to be critical to our ability as a country, never mind as a commonwealth, to get access to the personal protective equipment that people need to actually do this job and do it well. The other thing I would say, Jonathan, in response to your question, do not underestimate the power and the importance of telehealth. Nobody has to go face-to-face, close contact, between a patient and a provider to execute on a video chat or a phone call. The safest way to engage, if you have symptoms or you're concerned you have symptoms, with your provider is to call them up, or if they have access to video chat capability, whatever way it might be, use it. That keeps them safe, and frankly, it keeps you safe too. If you're actually not as sick as you think you might be, you don't have to go into a medical community where other people who might be there would be, and you could get it from them. I can't emphasize this enough. It's a covered benefit. Providers who offer the service are going to get paid for it. You are going to get treated by your clinician, and it keeps both of you safer than you would be if you chase it the other way, the more traditional way. So I just urge everybody to take advantage of this. Well, there's two things going on here, and they're both legit. One is a concern that we have about the importance of many forms of construction. As long as people act on the guidance that was issued by state agencies and by the command center to keep people safe, there's a lot of work there that is, in our view, essential to the Commonwealth, whether you're talking about housing or transportation or infrastructure. And by the way, if you look at the federal guidelines on this, infrastructure is right there on the list of things that they consider to be essential. But that said, in the guidelines that we issued, one of the things we said was that the act of actually overseeing and enforcing this stuff needs to be done at the municipal level for municipal permitted work. Okay? Boston and several other municipalities have said, and it's a fair point, that they don't believe they're in a position at this point to do the work that would be associated with ensuring that those guidelines were being adhered to on the ground on all the projects that are either underway or planned. If you think about Boston in particular, they probably have somewhere between 10 and 11,000 construction workers working in the city at any point in time. And I am very sympathetic to the mayor's point of view that until he feels comfortable that the actual act of overseeing and enforcing those guidelines which we care about a lot too, because we don't want people to be working in an unsafe manner, can be adhered to, he's not going to open back up, and I get that.
You've been listening to a special broadcast, live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker and his team at the State House with their daily coronavirus update. I'm Tiziana Deering of Radio Boston. Anthony Brooks from WBUR has also been listening to that and joins us now. Anthony, how are you?
Hey, Tiziana, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So, Anthony, very different themes today from yesterday. Yesterday's briefing seemed to be focused on education. Today, two big headlines were the reopening of the Newton Pavilion to provide health care for homeless people who may be suffering from the virus and an application to FEMA for a major disaster declaration. What does it seem like the governor's really focusing on overall today with his announcements?
Well, I think you mentioned two of the big things he talked about. He also talked about, very importantly, sort of started off here, talking about how the state is continuing to make progress in expanding its capability to test people for the coronavirus. And as we've been hearing day after day, this is hugely important. He said this time last week we'd completed 2,600 tests, but the state has since enlisted the help of the Broad Institute and a number of other labs, and there are now 21 labs working on testing, and that adds capability to do something like 2,000 additional tests a day, I think he said. So that's key. And of course, he made the point that more testing means identifying more people who are infected with the coronavirus, but that's a crucial part of saving lives and reducing the spread. But it's also going to continue to put out alarming numbers as this epidemic continues to sweep across this country and indeed across the Commonwealth as well.
Yeah, you know,
so that was certainly one of the go ahead.
No, actually, you go ahead and finish, and then I'll come back with a question.
No, I had finished. I just thought that sort of stood out to me. He also talked about, the need to expand the number of hospital beds for what's expected to be a surge in cases. You mentioned, I think you mentioned as well, that it's seeking a federal disaster declaration, which, if approved, would deliver more money, more financial assistance through FEMA, including disaster unemployment assistance, which obviously is a huge thing with so many people out of work now.
You noted that the governor opened with talking about testing and the fact that the state continues to ramp up. That was a really interesting bookend because at the very end, in response to one of the questions, he very openly expressed some frustration with this ability to do what he called landing the order, which seemed like a frustration on the state level of being able to get a hold of emergency supplies, especially, and we know that he complained to President Trump about a week ago that states couldn't compete with the federal government on that. Was it remarkable to hear him talk about that frustration and the importance of landing the order?
I mean, remarkable in the sense it's not something we hear all the time, but I just think everything we're hearing these days, whether it's news out of Washington, whether it's the Senate approving the biggest relief bill in history, whatever it is that we're talking about when it comes to this crisis and this emergency is remarkable. I give Baker an awful lot of credit for always maintaining a kind of cool sort of steadiness about whatever it is he's talking about, even though he's talking about unprecedented events and an enormous challenge for state officials and federal officials, not to mention ordinary citizens. But yeah, it's a pretty remarkable, I think, is a good way to put it, Tiziana.
The other thing I really noticed, Anthony, we've been watching these briefings for several days now, and there was this moment where Governor Baker got into the nuts and bolts for people of how you have to accurately fill out your unemployment request in a
really
way that right? Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, this is the former Secretary of Administration and Finance, right? I mean, Charlie Baker knows this stuff, and he just was talking about the huge surge in unemployment numbers. We'll talk about that in a moment. But he says, by the way, folks, if you're filling out an unemployment form, be sure to put the actual name of your former employer as it shows up on your W-2 form. Because if you don't do that, the system kicks out the application and a lot of people get frustrated. Extraordinary that a governor who's taking, who has to take account of so many things is immersed in that level of granular detail. Don't forget, line 62A of an unemployment application. But speaking of those unemployment numbers, he said it reflects what's going on not just here in Massachusetts, but around the country because of all this social distancing, all of the people out of work. a 15-fold increase in applications for unemployment claims. He said this is going to be a huge challenge for the state processing this huge surge in claims. He said at a call center there were 50 people working in it last week. They're all working remotely this week. Now there are 300 people processing those claims. By this time next week, he says there'll probably be 400 people.
One of the other more detailed things that he got asked, Anthony, that he didn't have an answer to yet, and I wanted to get your read on this, was sort of, whether and why the Commonwealth has not matched the federal government in postponing the tax filing date to later in the summer.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a read on that or can really add much to that, other than to say there are just so many details that come out of this emergency that chief executives have to deal with. And for whatever reason, and maybe there are people out there smarter than me who can analyze this, that's one detail that hasn't been dealt with yet in a way that, quite makes sense. But
he did seem to say, essentially, don't worry about it. We're going to get it taken care of. Was that your sense of what the governor was saying?
Yeah, that's pretty much more or less what I heard as well.
Another thing that I noticed, Anthony, and I wanted to ask you about, there were a number of times that the governor struck themes about just the time it takes to ramp up response, supply chains, government capacity to handle unemployment filing, the ability of schools to put together lessons plans, getting the partnership with public television in order to provide lessons to schools. There was this constant theme that the speed of the response is being outstripped by the speed of the virus. Can you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, I heard that, and I think it's true, and I just think it sort of goes back to this point that there's so many parts of the system that are under stress and that have to be brought up to speed. But, I'd sort of go back to the beginning of the briefing where he's talking about testing capacity, these really important things like testing capacities and beds and filing unemployment claims and all of those sorts of things seem to be ramping up fairly dramatically and fairly quickly. But of course, there's so many things that have to ramp up that we're really getting a sense of the magnitude every day as we hear more and more of these briefings. We really are getting a sense of the magnitude of this challenge because there are so many different parts of it that are so dramatic and have to be attended to. So I think that's one of the themes that came across loud and clear today.
So, Anthony, in our last 30 seconds, the Senate unanimously passed a stimulus bill last night. It goes to the House on Friday. Are you optimistic that it will pass? And what are your reactions to what you've seen?
I think there's no doubt that it's going to pass. I mean, it passed unanimously in the Senate. I think Democrats who control the House will probably sort of hold their nose about some of the big corporate help for huge corporations. But the Democrats fought pretty hard in the Senate to make sure that there was a lot of help for small businesses. $1,200 for individuals who make $75,000 or less. They'll get an extra $500 for each dependent child. So there's a lot in this bill. $2 trillion, the biggest aid package ever passed by Congress. But
Anthony Brooks,
it's not going to be enough.
I'm going to have to take it back from you there. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It's been a special broadcast live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker and Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutter's daily update on the coronavirus.